Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, on American Variety, we often have people who do unusual things, kind of who pursue odd paths through life that are colorful or interesting or even dangerous or risky, you know. And I've had quite a number of people on over the last, gosh, 5.5 to 6 years of American Variety who've had colorful careers of various kinds. And our show today is one such thing. We're going to talk about circuses in general, and in particular, we're going to talk with someone named Jamie McVicker, who has written a book about his time in, well, I guess, the biggest circus in the country, the Ringling Barnum Brothers and Bailey. Well, he can say it better than I can. Welcome, Jamie.
Thanks very much, Court. I'm glad to be here.
Glad you could be with us. You know, I remember the heyday of circuses, maybe toward the end of the heyday of the big top circus, right, that made circuits all around the country. And so in Miami, I remember going to a circus, you know, out in this big sandy field, and the big tops were up and all this excitement. And in the sandy field, as people were leaving, everyone's big old heavy cars got stuck in the sand. And so the big excitement was that the elephants would come around and wrap their trunk around your bumper and pull you out of the sand with the kids in the car and all that. So that was like probably more exciting than the entire circus that we had just sat through, was having a humongous elephant pull our car out of the sand and over to the paved parking lot or whatever. And it was like a great end to the show. And I still remember, I was probably 5, right? But I remember it very vividly right now. So really, I mean, I think circuses were at one time a huge part of America and of the childhood experience of generations of people. And that's what we're going to talk about today, because Jamie's book is called The Advance Man, A Journey into the World of the Circus. Jamie is someone who had an ad agency in the Washington, D.C. area for a long time, a very successful large ad agency. But before that time, this is a memoir. It's a story of a phase of his life right after college when you, Jamie, were an advance man. And you can tell us in a minute what an advance man is. I guess it's not somebody who issues advances on your loan or something. But so that was an early phase of your career. And why don't you just kind of plunge in and maybe, Jamie, give us a brief history of the circus in America, since I kind of alluded to the early days, at least in my life, of when the circus was a bigger thing. When did the circus start and how did it kind of grow big in America, and what was it like in the early days?
Okay. Well, first of all, so the listeners aren't confused later on, let me just explain to you what an advanced man was.
Okay.
We worked for the modern-day circus. I joined the show back in the mid-1970s when Irvin Feld was running the show. At the time, Mattel owned it.
Mattel, the toy company?
That's correct.
Okay.
And we had two units, the blue unit and the red unit, and they crisscrossed, playing about 180 dates around the country. And there were roughly 11 or 12 advance men, and our job was to go in front of the circus. We'd usually go alone. We'd go into a town 2 to 3 months, often doing two towns at the same time in advance of the circus, and then our job was to fill the seats, do all the marketing, the publicity, the promotions, the co-promotions, and then because we had lined up performer interviews and we had to audit the show, we were the first to come, and then after the circus arrived, the last to go. And we'll talk more about that later, but that was fundamentally what an advance man did. We were the old-time cigar-smoking, chomping promoters,
yeah.
Except for this was the 1970s, not the 1850s, and we were using a grab bag of finely tuned marketing tools.
So, yeah, I think the key word is promoter. That's what I really would call this. It's kind of the promoter who comes to town and gets the excitement build up in advance of the circus's arrival, right?
Correct. And what the book does, it's the only book that's been written from this perspective that I've ever been able to really locate, but it does fundamentally three things. It's an inside look at Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus, the largest traveling entertainment conglomerate on the globe, from a perspective that hadn't been told. It's marketing and promotion, as was taught to me by the masters, so I try to teach a craft in the book. And then thirdly, it's just a very, very compelling story of what happens to this young man in a pre-cell phone, pre-internet stage, thrown into the middle of nowhere, suitcase in hand. So that's what The Advance Man is about. Now, do you want me to go back and talk a little bit about the origins of the circus?
Yeah, I think so, because that's like the first part of the book. It's kind of like a James Michener book. It's a big book, and the first part of it is really like a Michener book would. It kind of gives the landscape in which the whole subsequent book is set, right? And the landscape here was the history of the circus from back in the mid-1800s. So, yeah, if you wouldn't mind, give us a brief thumbnail sketch of that.
Well, that's what I really try to do. I take the very beginning, the history section of the book, and take you back to sort of another time before even the turn of the century, looking around the 1860s or 1870s. Now, of course, the circus goes back all the ways to the days of the Circus Maximus in the Roman Colosseums. But for our purposes, in looking at the formation of Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey, if we go back to the 1880s and 1890s, what I like to do is address it, to take you back there in terms of thinking of the senses, sight, sound, hearing, smell. Because in many ways, modern times, have even though it's eradicated many of our discomforts, in many ways it's also dulled the senses. So if you go back there and you think about the smell of oven-baked bread and pipe tobacco and the pinging of the radiator, if you live near a river, your road, and you could feel the oars in your hands, there weren't grocery stores back then, so the food arrived fresh from the farm, fresh berries, fresh game. It was very much a different world. There were no child labor laws back then, and probably wouldn't have mattered much if there were, because it was an agricultural economy. But at the turn of the century, there were hundreds of tent shows that were crisscrossing the country. Back in those days, you didn't have arenas. So these tent shows basically housed everything from opera companies, theatrical groups, musicians, almost any form of saleable entertainment imaginable. But the one thing that, you know, nothing could possibly compare with for children of all ages was the arrival outside of the towns of the circuses. And if I might say one other thing, Court, about those days, you have to remember that at a time when there was a thirst for knowledge, there were no movies, there was no TV, and even after there were, the circus was the precursor to the modern zoo. Its menagerie presented animals that had only been seen in illustrations.
Yeah.
It was a museum of new innovation shaping the country. In the sideshows, they'd exhibit the phonograph and the sewing machine and the telephone and these types of things.
Yeah.
And in an age of really trying to understand outside cultures, it was bringing in Australian Aborigines and natives with elongated earlobes. In many ways, it was a National Geographic.
Yeah.
So basically, it wasn't just another form of entertainment. It was a freshwater river, really, in a vast ocean of people with just a thirst for knowledge. And that was kind of the origins of the circus at the turn of the century.
It's hard to imagine a time, you know, before not only the internet, not only TV, but before even radio, out in the middle of the country or pretty much anywhere away from the big cities, where information was just a famine. There was no, like you said, it's a river coming into a desert of people were curious about things, or they might have read about things, you know, that happened years ago, but information just wasn't traveling around. And so the great outside world out there was a subject of tremendous mystery. And so the circus brought all that mystery and all that color into town in one big gush, right? So as you described, it was not only the greatest event of the year for the kids, but probably for many of the adults too, right?
So. Well, you know, I think another way to look at this too, Court, is you're absolutely right. But, you know, today, I was just thinking the other day, you can't be bored. Within 15 minutes of my house, there's a dozen different movie theaters.
Yeah.
I can rent a DVD. I can turn on my television. I can put in a CD. And all of that is wonderful, and we probably wouldn't want to give it up. But I remember even when I was a child, when the county fair would come, I would save, you know, my newspaper route money for weeks in anticipation and looking forward to that. So I think it was kind of different. There wasn't as much entertainment back then, but there was a lot more excitement.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Jamie McVicker about his recently published book, The Advance Man, A Journey into the World of the Circus, and about his time in the circus. But right now we're talking about kind of the early days of the circus. So they're, without getting into detail about it, Jamie, in the first part of your book, you talk about the circus from a business standpoint in terms of the mergers and consolidations that went on throughout that period from, I guess, the 1860s on into the 1920s and 30s and 40s. But you went to work then for the biggest one of all, the one that survived all of the internecine warfare of the circuses, right? What was the name of it again? I started at the beginning to say it. I'm not sure I got it right.
The greatest show on earth, Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Yeah, you say that like an advanced man. So, the greatest show on earth. I forgot that part. So tell us the story of your time in the circus, which began, I think you said, in about 1974.
Right. Well, I really think that it was one of those jobs that if 0.01% of anybody in the world did it, I would be surprised. But as I started at the beginning, we were the advanced men, and there were only a dozen of us, and we literally lived out of a suitcase. So the book is not only about teaching the very basics of advertising and marketing taught, in my view, by the masters, the people who invented the word, it was also what was this lifestyle like. And remember, there weren't any internets, there weren't any cell phones, even then back in the 70s, and you'd be assigned a couple of cities, and off you would go, and in the beginning, you weren't getting paid anything. You'd run out of money on a Wednesday and not eat till Friday.
You're kidding.
But you'd book yourself in a little motel, and you were going to be in that town by yourself for a good 2 to 3 months, often doing two towns at a time. So it was sort of this dual existence, this combination on one hand of all of this this incredible adrenaline rush from promoting the big circus. At a very young age, we were only in our 20s, we suddenly had these huge budgets we could spend. We all absolutely loved what we did, or we wouldn't have been doing it. And then, while at the same time, it could be horribly lonely and isolating, and you're part of the circus, but you're not until the circus comes into town. And so it was an incredible roller coaster of a lifestyle.
So you were a PR guy to a great extent. I mean, what did you do? Who did you connect with when you'd blow into a town and the circus was on its way 2 months later?
Well, what we would do is we would always hire the local advertising agency, and we would base our offices out of their firm. And we mainly did it for credibility purposes. Well, we did it for a couple of reasons. Number one, they provided us secretarial help. They provided us a roof over the head. They provided us with the local contacts for setting up our deals. But even more importantly, it was the credibility with our creditors so that the people in local towns knew that we were going to pay the bill. There's a circus expression, and promoters, we would ask each other, did you make your nut? Do you know where that comes from, Court?
No, I've heard the phrase all my life, and I never really thought about it. Where?
We would ask each other, did you make your nut? And what we were asking each other was, did you make your projections? Mm-hmm. Did you make your sales projections?
Yeah.
And where the term originated is when the little circuses would come into town, the sheriff would immediately show up and take off the axle nuts to their wagons so that they couldn't leave town until they paid all their bills.
You had to earn your nuts
so
back.
So basically, having the advertising agency saved us from having to have our nut confiscated. So there you go.
So to speak. We won't go there. So,
and at other times, we might also hire a local publicist or public relations agency if it was a large market, say a Cleveland or New York or Detroit or something of that nature.
So you would hire an ad agency, but I guess you also did interviews with radio shows and the newspapers and so on. I guess you set up interviews with the stars of the show who would be coming, that kind of thing, right? Or did they do all that, the ad agency?
No, the ad agency fundamentally might make some introductions and would handle the affidavits and the final media placement, but otherwise we really did, 95% of everything we had to do. And what the book kind of illustrates, and then this is an interesting point, Cord. There's a blog talking about my book recently, and it's all about live event marketing. And having read the book, the man Joe Louis said, we're so caught up in trying to stay ahead of the curve with this new technology of twitting and social networking and Googling, et cetera, in terms of advertising and promotion, that we've forgotten what fantastic promotions and things that we used to do that are still effective and still work. And he brought up the movie Avatar, saying what a success it was, and it was using both some of these modern methods, but had not lost, the use of the traditional methods of advertising and promotion, too. But what we did that was probably so remarkable, and we did it through alliances. If I came into a town with $10,000 to spend in advertising, I think that was my budget in Savannah, Georgia in 1974, by the time I was through, I would have probably had $60,000 or $70,000 worth of advertising exposure.
Hmm.
And we did that through three different ways. Number one is we created alliances, and every business could still do this today, and it's just sort of combining your what you have, what your strengths are with someone else. For example, you might think to yourself, what in the world would the Safeway grocery store in Savannah have to do with Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus? Well, the way we would look at it was we could combine what we both needed. I might approach Safeway and say, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a Safeway night at the circus. You can have an honorary ringmaster. And we're going to make a great big deal out of all that. So I'm also going to give you discount tickets for the matinee shows that you can give every single one of your patrons for the next 2 months or whatever it is for a Tuesday, Thursday show. So suddenly they have a reason to attract more people. They have a prestigious evening. They can take their employees to the show. But what do I get out of it? They snipe all of their advertising, which is tens of thousands of dollars, with the Ringling Brothers coming to town. Posters are hung up in the store. The discount coupon for matinee shows, which are light anyway, and suddenly we have a win-win situation where I haven't spent one single dime and have just received thousands of dollars worth of advertising. And we did that, and I kind of illustrate that in the book over and over and over again with all kinds of different alliances and promotions.
So by the end of your time there, you'd pretty much engage the whole town in the imminent arrival of the circus, like it's almost like the invasion of the Martians or something. The circus is coming and everybody's engaged in one way or another. That's wild.
Well, you know, they certainly were. In fact, I can remember my boss, who was only 28 at the time, and we were all such serious, ambitious young businessmen, you kind of forget how young we were. But usually his parting comment to me when he would send me to the next town, say, Jamie, I want no stone left unturned.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Jamie McVicker, who's written a book recently published called The Advance Man, A Journey into the World of the Circus. And we're talking about the circus and his particular journey into its world. So, Jamie, when you were involved with the circus, tell us about some of the things that happened to you, or maybe some of the particular colorful characters that were there. And there certainly were extremely colorful characters in your book and in the circus.
Well, there really were. I can remember I'd only been on the job for about 2 weeks when I was told to pick up Mishu at the train and take him to a radio interview. Well, Mishu was a Hungarian Lilliputian, perfectly proportionate, but he was only the size of a 9-month-old, 33 inches tall, and about 25 pounds. And at the time, Mishu would have been in his mid to late 30s. But I'll never forget going to the train. He was still asleep. I woke him up. He got up. He was kind of known for being a bit of a womanizer, and women would pick him up thinking that he was a little baby, and he would be kind of snuggling and nuzzling.
Oh, yeah, right.
He also loved his vodka profusely. But anyway, this one particular morning, I picked him up, and his hands immediately went up, and I was almost kind of surprised. And I picked him up and cradled him in my arm, and off we went. Well, we got there a little bit early, and we sat in a restaurant, and he didn't really want to make a scene, and his voice was kind of high and squeaky, so he came around, and he just pitched his elbow, kind of crooked his elbow on my knee, and that's how we had a conversation. And he couldn't stand the performance director, who was also the lion tamer, Charlie Bauman. And Charlie Bauman couldn't stand him because he couldn't control him, because both equally were stars in the owner, Urban Feld's, mind. And I often wondered if Charlie Bauman, one of the most virile men in the world, ever really realized he was being stymied by the world's smallest man.
He could have crushed him in one hand, but he wasn't allowed to.
I'll never forget one time, Mishu used to like to walk behind the, you know, back in the dressing rooms, he'd walk behind the performers and he would punch him in the back of the knee. One time Muhammad Ali was back there. Muhammad Ali picked him up with both hands, held him up in front of his face, and Mishu dead seriously pointed at him and said, I will destroy you.
Oh my gosh.
And it was said that that was the only time Muhammad Ali was speechless.
There was a character whose name I remember from back in those days, named Gunter Gable Williams. Who was he and what did he do?
Well, Gunter was a big star for Circus Williams, and when Urban Feld first bought the circus from John Ringling North, he was revamping the show, needed some headliners, heard about Gunther, who was really just everything from tiger trainer, animal trainer, you name it, a fantastic athlete. And he had a contract that he couldn't break out, so Irvin just bought the entire show, Circus Williams. And Gunther was just a huge, you know, fascinating moneymaker, shocking blonde hair, could do flips onto the backs of elephants, you name it, for just many, many years. Died at a fairly early age in his mid-60s from brain cancer, of all things.
So part of your book goes into kind of the intrigue of counting the tickets, I mean, just the basic nuts and bolts money-making part of it, making sure that the money was accounted for in terms of the tickets that were theoretically sold, the tickets that were printed, and how many butts were in the seats out there in the circus, and did that sort of notionally match up in a visual way with the tickets that were sold? And so there's a whole lot of kind of a big part of the plot of the book goes into that, and maybe we won't tell that part of it and let our readers who want to buy your book read that part themselves. But that was pretty interesting. And maybe just give me a synopsis of how the ticket selling went and the tension between the event owner and the circus people, the circus business people, who were kind of mistrustful of each other to some extent in terms of who was cheating who, right?
Well, it really was. You know, it had kind of a rich history. Back in the old days, the ticket sellers actually used to pay the circus owners for the privilege of being able to sell tickets so that they could shortchange the customers. So it had a rich history of people automatically not trusting each other. And I'll never forget when I first joined the circus, my supervisor took me out and I said, "What are we doing?" He said, "Well, we have to watch doors." And we stood there minutes on end, and I would be watching the ticket takers, not the sellers, but the takers as the people came in. And finally, after about 20 minutes, I said, "What exactly are we watching for?
Well,
this is great, but what is it?
Does the door need grease?"
And he said, "Collusion." And he then explained to me one method whereby there's dollar off kid stubs could be palmed by the ticket taker, turned into the box office, and the take could have been split. That was just one example. But fundamentally, there wasn't much trust between, you know, any of the shows that came in. And even today, well, I'm not sure about today, but certainly back then, the arena box office. Now, the arena box office could only break even. What we would do is we'd go into a building, we'd count all of the empty seats. We would then designate the prices for the seats, and then we would give them the tickets. They never printed the tickets, we did. And then fundamentally, after every performance, they had to either turn into us an unsold hard ticket or cash. And that's the way it worked. And there were just a variety of different ways if people wanted to that they could take us, and perhaps vice versa. And so it was kind of an air of distrust.
Do these big top circuses still exist, Jamie? I mean, the one I remember, you know, because I was a little kid, but it seemed like it covered, you know, three football fields, and maybe it did. I don't know. Are they on that scale? And do they still exist like that, the traveling circus that would come into town on a train and they'd unpack all the stuff and the elephants would get off? Does that still go on?
I'm going to tell you that answer, but I'm going to stop back for one little anecdote first about tickets. It may sound boring, but I'll never forget that we were in, I was working in Cleveland with Mike Franks, my supervisor. It was a brand new office building, and just before the show, just before opening night, I began getting these phone calls of people saying, "I sent in my check, but I still haven't received my tickets." And so finally, Mike said, "You know, what's up?" We went over to the box office. The guy said, "I am just so sorry. We're so behind. I don't know what to do." And he also handed Mike about four messages from Urban Phil because we haven't given him the numbers in a week. We go into an office, and there's $250,000 worth of tickets still piled up in trash cans.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was wondering, what are we going to tell Urban Phil where his money is?
You're
going to
be in the trash can.
Anyway. Exactly. So. Your question, you know, it's interesting. I don't think the circus has really abated. I mean, Cirque du Soleil came in with a different style. It's extremely well done. It's more athletic. It's less animals. And apparently they've done extremely well with shows in Vegas, et cetera. But, you know, I went to Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey last year right here in Northern Virginia. It was a Saturday afternoon, and the show rocked. There had to be 9,000 people there. I was actually amazed at how little things had changed. Many, many of the acts, the timing of the acts were the same. As long as there's children and family entertainment, the circus is going to be popular. Now, there are still, we used to call them mud shows, but there's still 10 shows. There's about 20 of them that circle around the United States. It's very popular. There's a lot of tent shows that are still in Europe. They play largely the smaller towns and medium venues, but, you know, many of them do very well.
I'm sure you're right then, but I really don't hear of them, or I'm not aware of them, or maybe they just don't come around where I am or something. But I thought that, you know, between TV, you know, which is obviously a continuous form of nearly free entertainment, and the internet, and also, you know, if you want to go somewhere to see it, Cirque du Soleil, which also was on TV for a long time, but Vegas shows were, you know, I guess there's the two guys who do the tiger and lion show in Las Vegas until one of them got...
Siegfried and Roy.
Yeah, until one of them got torn up pretty badly, but I guess they're back at it to some extent. But I just thought that those different venues and outlets for entertainment of that type had just pretty much made circuses obsolete. So it's interesting to hear that they're not. I just figured they had been, but you would know, I guess.
Well, they're not. And again, you don't see them as much in the big cities, because one of the things that the circuses, even back in the 1800s and turn of the century, a lot of the advanced men, is it was very cooperative. There really wasn't anything to be gained by two and three circuses all competing with one another on the same schedule. So they'd be cooperating and often avoid each other. And I think that's partly true to this day. The Big Apple may come in and set up at the Tyson's Mall, for example, and then Ringling Brothers comes in, which is the big thing with the arena, and the smaller tent shows know that they're going to do better in the towns of 15 or 20,000 people or 30 or 40 or whatever.
Sure.
But it's still alive, and the lifestyle is still there. As a matter of fact, there's an organization called the Circus Fans of America that's very popular with 2,000 members. There is the American Youth Circus Organization, and all they do is help train and provide guidance for young people, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, which is how many of the acrobats and things would start. To this day, they can go there, learn how to be jugglers and clowns and acrobats and have a circus career. So it's not as well promoted, but it's still there and still strong.
So it is pretty amazing that circuses are still there and still holding a piece of the pie for that kind of entertainment. I remember when I was a little kid, the ones I went to had freak shows, which I doubt is something that they still have today. I mean, I can remember going in all kind of scared to see Myrtle the Turtle Girl, who was some poor woman who was born without arms and legs, and, you know, who was just a trunk with a head, and they had her propped up and, I guess, painted or dressed somehow to look like a turtle. So those were freak shows, and they had geeks. The term geek originated from, I think, someone who would eat rats and things like that in front of you. So, you know, tabloid TV to some extent has taken over some of that, and there are even TV shows that, you know, like the show Little People, for example, does some of that in terms of presenting people who are physically unusual. But do they still have freak shows in circuses today that you know of?
You know, that really ended a long time ago. That really hasn't been around. So that's not nearly as big of an issue.
Yeah, I would hope so. That was pretty crude.
But, you know, one of the things you have to understand, and this is one of the reasons that Ringling Brothers almost went bankrupt. In fact, it did go bankrupt back in the 50s and 60s. It's enormously expensive to have a traveling entertainment show where you do have tents. And now with modern-day transportation costs like gasoline and trucks or train, it just makes it exorbitantly risky. And that's one of the reasons it moved to more stationary venues. But I'm happy to report that it's alive and well. And, not only did I serve with the Ringling Brothers for 3 years as an employee, it took me 17 years to write, research, edit, and bring this book to market. So in many ways, it was such an exciting part of my life, it never really left.
Well, I was going to ask you that, if you could kind of wrap up by saying very briefly, how did that experience change you, Jamie, and shape you as a person, if you can do that in 25 words or less?
Well, from there, I became the president and owner of a graphic design and marketing communications firm, like you said at the beginning of the show. And what I had as an advantage that nobody else did, that basically had an art directing background, is I'd come in and not ask, what typeface do you want? I'd ask, now, are there other ways to look at who you're trying to reach and how to do it? And I'd win, you know, all kinds of business because of the Ringling background that I had. So, I mean, to me, it was one of the most exciting times in my life. It was the foundation of my business career in advertising and marketing. It was the foundation of my career as a writer. This is my second book, and I've done a dozen articles. And so, and in many ways, I grew enormously from having experienced the loneliness of being on the road and learned a little bit about about limitations and ambition and balance in life.
It's one of those experiences that everybody should have when they're young. And so the book, The Advance Man, A Journey into the World of the Circus, tell us how we can get a hold of it, Jamie.
Well, most people buy books, or many of them, by Amazon today. So you can just click in that title, The Advance Man, A Journey into the World of the Circus, and go to any Barnes & Noble or Borders or your local bookstore. And if they don't have the book, they can easily get it for you as well.
And if you want to do it by author's name, Jamie McVicar, M-A-C-V-I-C-A-R, and I will use that to thank you, Jamie McVicar, for being on with us here on American Variety today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Enjoyed talking with you. Thanks to all for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.